Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London with me, Sean Lay. Israel has opened a new front in its war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, against its finances. A bank was the latest and perhaps surprising target of Israel's airstrikes. Overnight Sunday into Monday, buildings belonging to Al-Qaeda Al-Hassan were destroyed. Daniel Hagari is the Israeli military spokesman.
One of our main targets last night was an underground vault with millions of dollars in cash and gold. The money was being used to finance Hezbollah's attacks on Israel. This vault was deliberately located under a residential building. Our strikes will degrade Hezbollah's ability to finance its attacks on Israelis.
Daniel Hagari. Well, the bank, however, describes itself as a charitable institution which issues loans but follows Islamic principles in not charging interest for them. Meanwhile, Israel says it's identified another Hezbollah bunker full of cash and gold hidden under a Beirut hospital, but it says it won't strike the hospital itself. In Syria, the Israelis say they killed someone they describe as the head of Hezbollah's money transfer unit. So just how extensive is Hezbollah's financial footprint? Hanin Gadah is a Friedman Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute and author of the book Hezbollah Land. She began by telling me about the AQAH financial network.
The Qaeda Al-Hassan is what Hezbollah says it's an association. It's a social part of their social services network. However, it does act like a bank. It is part of their large banking system, and it has 30 branches in Lebanon. When in 2019, during the Lebanon financial crisis, and the banks basically stopped acting like banks, more people put their money in the Qaeda Al-Hassan, and it took loans from the Qaeda Al-Hassan. And in order to take a loan, they take usually gold. So it has a lot of gold, it has a lot of cash, and it does have dealings with a lot of Iranian entities like Mahan Air and some of their financial and the IRGC entities. So it does act like a bank. It is a bank, and it has a lot of connections with Iranian figures and Iranian institutions. That's why Hezbollah relies largely on it to launder their money or to basically use the money in order to buy what they need. It doesn't act like a bank in terms of credit cards and credit limits. It is a cash economy. Hezbollah's economy is a cash economy, so everything they have is in cash.
The Americans first sanctioned it in 2007. In 2021, it sanctioned individuals connected with the bank. If they were so certain, why hasn't this been entirely disconnected from the banking system years ago? Or is it not possible in a country like Lebanon?
It is not part of the banking system. It has its own system. It is part of Hezbollah's system. Mm. So the people who are in charge of it is not the Central Bank of Lebanon. They have no access to it. It's not registered in Lebanon as a bank. So it's not really part of the banking system.
And yet, judging by the numbers of depositors, as you said, a lot of people kind of flock to it when the conventional banks collapsed. 406,783 registered depositors in 2020. So it must have a significant impact on all ordinary Lebanese to take it out.
Correct. The thing is that today everyone is trying to reach their Hezbollah official in their town or village or city to see what happened to their money or to their gold. And the thing is that what happened Yesterday, the strike on the 30 branches of Al-Qaeda Al-Hassan was just a strike on their offices, right? The money, the actual money, most of it, we're talking about $1 to $2 billion US dollars. Most of it has already burnt during the strikes on Dahiyeh that happened since the assassination of Hezbollah's leader, Hassan Nasrallah. There has been, on that night, 30 strikes on Dahiyeh.
So when Israel says tonight, or issues information tonight saying it has struck Hezbollah bunker holding millions of dollars in cash and gold, that's probably what happened back then several weeks ago.
Most of it is already gone, burnt and stolen. However, I think I see this more of a political message, a push internally within Lebanon to tell the Shia that your money is gone, to tell Hezbollah's constituency that your money is gone. It's a way of countering Hezbollah internally as well, because even if the money was gone a couple of weeks ago, the people do not know that. What they know now, they know. So it's basically, it's a push to counter Hezbollah financially, militarily, and now within its own constituency, more pressure on them to release the money. And once they don't, it will be a real problem for Hezbollah within their Shia community.
What about the announcement tonight by the IDF that they've killed someone they describe as the head of Hezbollah's money transfer unit? What is the significance of that?
Yes, this is not the first financial Hezbollah person that was assassinated. In the past 2 weeks, we witnessed two assassinations of two people who were also responsible for Hezbollah's finances. One of them is actually in a Christian area, was hiding in a Christian area. Even before the war, there was a Mossad operation that killed one of their exchange people. So Hezbollah is powerful because of its military, but also without its money, it cannot rebuild. So I think what the Israelis are trying to do is to make sure that even when the war is over and ceasefire happens and they agree on everything, if Hezbollah wants to rebuild and regroup, they do not have the money to do that, knowing that Iran is not financially capable of sending the cash that they sent in the last war in 2006. So countering Hezbollah financially also contains them.
That's Hani Gadar, author of the book Hezbollah Land. Efforts are continuing to contain the conflict in Lebanon. The US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, America's most senior diplomat, is on his way back to the region. There is anxiety in Washington about Israel's continuing operations in Gaza and Lebanon, and deep concern, in the words of President Biden, about a leak of intelligence documents which contained the US's assessment of Israel's planned military retaliation against Iran. The US envoy for Lebanon, Amos Hochstein, is already in the country speaking to a range of political actors, including those who speak on behalf of Hezbollah. Mr. Hochstein is banned by US law from talking directly to that group. Speaking to the media after his arrival, he didn't sound hopeful.
This is a really heartbreaking moment for me to be here in Lebanon. The people of Lebanon, like everyone in the region, just want to go home, build a peaceful, secure, and safe and prosperous future for themselves and their families. This is my sixth or maybe seventh visit to Lebanon in the past year. And while we spent 11 months containing the conflict, we were not able to resolve it. In each of my visits, I cautioned that the situation was urgent and the status quo was not sustainable. We were either going to reach a solution or things were going to escalate out of control. I stood at this very podium time after time, including as recently as August, and cautioned about the urgency. A resolution was possible, but it was rejected, and the situation has escalated out of control, as we feared that it could.
Well, James Jeffrey served as U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Turkey, and as envoy on the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS, the group that calls itself Islamic State. I asked him what he made of Amos Hochstein's tone. He didn't sound very optimistic, did he?
He didn't. Remember, he's been doing this for almost a year now. After almost a year of daily strikes into northern Israel, and of course, Israeli response, the Israelis decided that this diplomatic track was not going to work. And we ought to ask ourselves why that was not so.
Why do you think they came to that conclusion?
My experience, and I don't want to blame the Biden administration, but all four of the last administrations, the other three I've been in, doesn't understand war, at least in the Middle East, against Iran and its proxies. Our default position is negotiate a ceasefire, de-escalate, try to find a compromise. Diplomacy is the way forward. Military force never does anything but open the door to a conflagration. The Israelis, after the 7th of October, don't believe that. They believe that military force can accomplish things, which, of course, in other contexts, we've believed, including in the fight against the Islamic State, where we did a military campaign that smashed the hell out of them in the end. So Amos was not equipped, I do not think, with the key talking point. And I know and have worked with him. He's very, very good. But he would have needed that key talking point, which was Lebanese friends, at some point, the Israelis are just going to come in a massive ground invasion, and they are going to take down Hezbollah, and they're going to do a great deal of destruction to your country in the process if you don't accept a ceasefire. Don't think Amos made that point.
Right. Well, I mean, presumably he would not have been authorized to make that point. That's
exactly
the broad point.
That's my
making.
Point. He wasn't authorized.
Yeah. In the United States, we have a lame duck president because he's at the end of his term, coming to the end of his term. His successor is going to be elected. Those two candidates are in a tight, unbelievably tight race that could end up dominating the news for the next few months. Israel appears to think it's winning, and at home, the war enjoys popular support. Is it your sense then that this is just going to continue with a process of prosecution of that war until Israel itself is satisfied that it's reached a conclusion?
I think Israel, as I said, it's in an existential fight. And as you saw from the New York Times report last week on the captured Hamas files, Hamas was seeking a multi-front assault on Israel to take down the whole country on the 7th of October. Mm. So Israel is going to fight until it removes that capability and reestablishes overwhelming deterrence. It still has to strike Iran, and we haven't seen that chapter written yet. I suspect that it's getting to the point after the killing of Sinwar that, from my standpoint, and I follow this closely, its campaign in Gaza has diminishing returns and ever more humanitarian and international diplomatic pressure. So I think that there's a chance for a ceasefire there. The fight against Hezbollah, that's another question. I think that if Amos can't get a ceasefire, that's going to go on until the Israelis are convinced that they have really done permanent and lasting damage to Hezbollah, and that's a long way away.
And the last minute or so we've had this leak, which the president describes himself deeply concerned by, which is reportedly documents shared within the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance, in other words, with a group of allied countries to the United States, giving some details of the military preparations by Israel for attacking Iran. How worried should they be by that?
They should be very worried by the leak. And let me say, this is the first I've heard it was Five Eyes, but from much experience, I can assure you, if this was a leak, it probably came from an American official. We're much sloppier on handling intelligence-sensitive information. We have a much broader group of people that are in on the action than the other four eyes have. And so he should be concerned. In terms of from everything I can see about the intelligence that was released, it doesn't help Iran that much. It's just a very embarrassing incident for us, and it's something we have to look into, obviously, urgently, or something really important will be leaked.
That's James Jeffrey, former US ambassador, talking to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Coming up, how does Russia feel about the prospect of another term of Donald Trump in the White House should he win the US election?
That was the value of Trump. He never preached on human rights in Russia. Trump seems to be more pragmatic and lacking certain principles. And being pragmatic and without principles, you make it easier to strike a deal.
Our headlines this hour. Israel says it's dismantled a spy network of seven citizens who'd gathered information for Iran on military bases and energy infrastructure. And a British police officer has been cleared of murder after he shot an unarmed black man in the head 2 years ago. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. It's time for another annual Conference of the Parties, or COP, this time on biodiversity in Cali, Colombia. The summit is seeking to build on the success of the last gathering in Montreal 2 years ago, which agreed on 23 targets. Among the goals this time, protecting at least 30% of each country's landmass. Opening the event, Colombia's Environment Minister Susana Mohamed urged delegates to reach meaningful agreements.
The planet doesn't have time to lose. Let's focus on the substantial issues in the negotiations. Let's help the chairs and co-chairs that are actually very experienced people to be able to come with solutions to move us forward in the methodology of negotiation.
Well, this year's host country is one of the most biodiverse places on the planet, so we asked two Colombians to tell us about their involvement with the work being done for its survival.
Hi, I am Vanessa Marin. I am 30 years old, and my job as a tourist guide here in Mesetas is to connect the visitors with the local communities so they can understand their culture and learn about the environment. As a child, I grew up surrounded by mountains, rivers, forests, but sadly, we had to leave this area because we were displaced during the armed conflict and we had to move to other parts of Colombia. We saw the peace process as a way to bring growth to the area. With this initiative of connecting people with conservation, we are changing the local community's mentality of hunting and destroying nature. We have been encouraging locals and tourists to look after the forest and water, and we have managed to make a difference. It is so important to change the way we live because of climate change. I think COP16, which is being held here in Colombia, it's a good opportunity for us to be heard and for the whole world to see that we have to look after nature and we have to give more opportunities to our future generations.
My name is John Castaneda. I'm 23 years old and I live in Mercedes, Colombia. The municipality of Mercedes is 827 meters above sea level. It's at the foothills of the Andes and the Macarena Mountains in the Colombian Llanos. Because of the location, it has a very varied ecosystem and large biodiversity in birds. We were able to find the information of 870 different bird species in the area. The area has such a large biodiversity because it extends to the paramos found in the high peaks of the Andes and the Amazon jungle. We are now developing the area for ecotourism and in this way helping to look after the environment. COP16 will be an opportunity to show Colombia and the world the riches and the importance of looking after our nature.
That's John Casanado, and before that you heard Vanessa Marin. As well as reviewing the implementation of previous promises, such as publishing national plans, which many countries have yet to do so, the COP in Colombia will also hear a demand that fungi should be recognised as a separate kingdom of life from flora and fauna. The idea comes from Juliana Forchi, chief executive of the Fungi Foundation. She's Chilean-British, and the proposal is being sponsored at COP16 by the British and Chilean delegations.
Fungi are separate. It's not this pledge that has separated fungi. Fungi have been recognized as an independent kingdom of life since 1969. They are factually, scientifically, neither plants nor animals. Most policy through legislation, public policies and agreements refers to the conservation of nature and moves to conserve biodiversity, referring to biodiversity only as flora and fauna, or animals and plants. Precisely because fungi are neither animals nor plants and are neither flora nor fauna is that we need to get the language right and include fungi in those political frameworks.
While we're getting the language right, what constitutes fungi? What sorts of things are we talking about? Give us some examples.
So included in the kingdom of the fungi are yeast, mold, mushrooms, lichens, wood ears, and many, many other. And without yeast, for example, we wouldn't have wine, beer, bread, chocolate, coffee. Without mold, we wouldn't have, for example, penicillin, one of the most important antibiotics that shaped the face of humanity. Without mushrooms and without the fungi that live on and in roots of trees, no plant could live outside of water. So basically, the world as we know it, the planet as we know it, could not be without the role of fungi.
And how are fungi different? from the other things that we characterize as flora?
Plants, for example, photosynthesize. They use the energy of the sun together with water to make food. Fungi don't do that. Animals ingest. They ingest, they digest inside their bodies, and fungi don't do that. Fungi live in a different way. They are organisms that live inside their food that connect things in nature in a way that plants and animals don't do. Fungi, in essence, are the organisms that make a system, an ecosystem. They are the organisms that decompose organic matter together with bacteria and allow for the fluxes of energy in nature. Their role is essentially different as living organisms.
How do you think policy has gone wrong because people haven't distinguished fungi?
One of the most graphic ways we can demonstrate the need for fungal conservation is the fact that when you are looking to conserve many animals, you can move them to zoos. You can take them out of their habitat and breed them in a different place and make sure that the species thrives and continues. With most plants, you can do something similar. You can take them away from their natural habitat and put them in botanic gardens, in nurseries, and have them thrive and reproduce. But with most fungi, you can't do that. And one of the most important things about fungal conservation is the fact that to conserve fungi, you need to conserve the habitats and the ecosystems in which they live. And I think it's pretty clear to most of us that just focusing on plants and animals has not had the expected effects of when this was planned decades ago. It's time to introduce these organisms into legislation so that we have a chance at conserving the ecosystems that we depend on.
How would you say fungi shape human lives?
No plant can live outside of water without fungi on and in their roots. So the atmosphere we live in is due to fungi. Most herbivores can't digest the plants they eat without the fungi in their stomachs, and therefore herbivores wouldn't exist, and which has been staple food for humanity in time. Without fungi, nothing would ferment because yeasts are fungi, and therefore the process of fermentation to preserve foods, you know, over the history of humanity and the shaping of humanity wouldn't have existed without fungi. And again, without fungi, nothing would decompose. The earth would be just a huge rubbish tip.
Sounds to me like you think it should really be fungi, flora and fauna.
Well, fauna and flora actually refer to the diversity of animals or plants in a given place or time, just like fungi refers to the diversity of fungi in a given time. So animals, plants and fungi, that are the names of the kingdoms, I'm fine with it just being in alphabetical order. We can say animal, fungi and plants.
Juliana, what do you think the prospects are? You've managed to persuade both the Chilean government and the British government to support this call at the COP. How confident are you that it will be adopted?
I'd say that this was a joint move between the countries and the Fungi Foundation. And because of that, I am very, very confident that the governments that decided to co-launch this pledge have all the conviction needed. And I very much hope that the Secretariat of the UNCPD takes this on and helps all of us move towards a healthier planet by including fungal conservation.
That was Juliana Forci of the Fungus Foundation welcoming us, as it were, to the kingdom of the fungi on Utah.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Even when Alexei Navalny was still alive, it was his wife Yulia who did a lot of the campaigning, first because he'd been poisoned with Novichok, then when the Russian opposition leader was jailed. Navalny died in a penal colony in February. A posthumous memoir is due. The BBC's culture editor Katie Razzle has been to meet his widow, Yulia Navalnaya.
Everything has changed in my life. everything has changed in our children's life. He was really not just a husband. He was the best friend.
And Alexei died on February the 16th, 2024, in one of Russia's most brutal prisons in the Arctic Circle. What do you believe happened to your husband?
I believe that Vladimir Putin is answering for the death and for the murder of my husband. We do have some evidence.
What evidence do you have?
I would like to come with the whole picture, what happened, not just with the random documents. Probably it will take a lot of time because he was in this cell alone. So, of course, it's very difficult to investigate all this.
When you say President Putin answers for your husband's death, is that what you mean, that President Putin ordered this?
Of course. I mean that he ordered this.
Now, the book contains diaries that Alexei wrote in prison. These diaries have never been seen before, certainly publicly. How did you feel reading your husband's prison diaries?
We exchanged a lot of letters when it was possible. So I knew even before diaries that he was tortured and he was starving.
And in the book, we read about him spending 295 days in solitary confinement.
And usually the normal practice is punishment just for 2 weeks. And my husband spent there almost 1 year.
Alexei was poisoned with Novichok, a nerve agent, in Siberia back in 2020. He was eventually evacuated to a German hospital for treatment. And you decided, the pair of you, once he was better, to go back to Russia in January 2021, even though he knew the regime had already tried to kill him. Just explain why.
It's not about we decided. It's about that you believe to person with whom you live so many years. I knew that he wants to be with his supporters, to be an example for all these people with his courage, with his bravery. There are a lot of people who support me, and I want to be supportive to them back.
And can you see yourself standing ever to be president of Russia? Is that your goal now?
My goal is to make all these changes happen. If I will come back to Russia, I will participate in the elections.
As a candidate?
As a candidate.
Yulia Navalnaya talking with Katie Russell. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Sean Lay. US Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump is refusing to confirm or deny claims in a new book that he's spoken by phone to Russian President Vladimir Putin up to 7 times since leaving office 4 years ago. Mr. Trump does, though, still boast of having a good relationship with the Russian leader. His rival for the Oval Office, by contrast, Kamala Harris, has called the Kremlin leader a murderous dictator. So what's being said inside Putin's nation about the Harris-Trump campaign? Here's the BBC's Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg.
It was November 2016, and down at the Russian parliament, they were handing out plastic cups and pouring champagne. The toast was to Donald Trump for winning the 2016 US election. Convinced that Russia now had a friend in the White House, ultra-nationalist MP Vladimir Zhirinovsky celebrated with 132 bottles of bubbly. True, the fizz went flat. President Trump didn't end sanctions against Russia or recognize Crimea as part of Russia. But the Kremlin was grateful for one thing he didn't do, and that was lecture Russia on democracy.
That was the value of Trump. He never preached on human rights in Russia.
Konstantin Remchukov is owner and chief editor of Russia's Nezavisimaya Gazeta. He believes that when it comes to Donald Trump versus Kamala Harris, Moscow is still attracted to Trump.
Trump seems to be more pragmatic and lacking certain principles. And being pragmatic and without principles you make it easier to strike a deal.
Does that include a deal on Ukraine?
Do you want Ukraine to win this war?
I want the war to stop. I want to save lives.
In the presidential debate, Trump refused to say whether he wants Ukraine to win the war against Russia. He's also criticized the scale of U.S. military assistance for Kyiv. Moscow will have appreciated that, but not this from Kamala Harris.
Because of the air defense, the ammunition, the artillery, the javelins, the Abrams tanks that we have provided, Ukraine stands as an independent and free country. If Donald Trump were president, Putin would be sitting in Kyiv right now.
And you should hear what they've been saying about Kamala on Russian state TV. This presenter suggests that Kamala Harris would be better off hosting TV cookery shows than being in the serious business of politics. Still, politics and cooking have one thing in common. It's easy to get your fingers burnt. Russia did in 2016 when it expected so much from the Trump presidency but received so little. Journalist Andrei Kolesnikov thinks that Moscow would be advised to keep that in mind in 2024.
I think it was a great disillusionment with Trump, for Putin after Trump's first term, because there were some hopes that now we should rule the world because Trump is in our pocket. But at the same time, the worsening of the relations, it was the initiative of Trump, paradoxically, despite the chemistry between two autocratic leaders.
But what does the Russian public make of America right now? How closely is it following the US election? To find out, I head to a park opposite Moscow's Novodevichy Convent. There's an unusual bronze monument here, a mother duck with eight ducklings. It was a gift from America at the end of the Cold War, a symbol of US-Soviet friendship. Although you wouldn't guess that, talking to Igor, who's fishing in the pond here. I want America to disappear, Igor tells me. It has started so many wars in the world. The US was our enemy in Soviet times, and it still is. It doesn't matter who's president there. But Nikita tells me, our two countries and two peoples should be friends, without competing to see who has more missiles. I prefer Trump. When he was president, there were no big wars. Marina likes the idea of a woman president. I'd vote for a woman, she says. I'm not saying it would be better or worse, but it would be different. It would indeed. Neither America nor Russia have ever had a woman president. For all their differences, it's one of the few things they have in common.
Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg with the Russian perspective on the US presidential election. Now, in our earlier edition of NewsHour on Monday, we brought the news that Moldova had voted narrowly in favour of joining the European Union. What's since emerged is just how narrowly. With the count complete, 50.46% voted yes, 49.54% voted no. Or to put it another way, 1.5 million Moldovans' votes were counted. The pro-EU vote was only 13,500 votes ahead of the anti-EU vote. These people in the capital Chisinau were divided on the result.
I think there should have been more votes, 60 to 70% for the European Union. But once again, the Russians have trampled us underfoot.
It might be that the majority voted yes, but personally I was against it, because I believe Moldova is supposed to find its own path in the realm of politics, in its development, in building its own future. The European Union is something else. It's not ours.
Mihai Popshoy is the country's foreign minister and deputy prime minister. NewsHour's Tim Franks asked what he made of this wafer-thin win.
It has been indeed a close election, but it is yet again a confirmation that every single vote counts. And we've been really honored to see this enormous mobilization, both at home, but especially in the diaspora, of citizens who want to see their country prosperous and peaceful and part of the European family of nations. So no matter that the odds were stacked against us, no matter how much the Kremlin tried to influence and impact negatively this election, no matter the hybrid tactics that have been used and the money that have been poured to bribe voters and to destabilize Moldova, the citizens have spoken loud and clear. It has been a historic turnout, and an absolute majority of Moldovan citizens have spoken in favor of European integration.
Well, much to pick out of that. One thing was you saying that Russia has poured in money to try and, your word, bribe voters. I mean, that is obviously a crime to try and buy a vote. Do you have hard evidence of that?
We do, and there are a number of criminal cases pending in our law enforcement. But also there was an incredible display of investigative journalism by one of the main newspapers here in Moldova, by a young and courageous journalist who was embedded in this organized criminal group undercover for a couple of months. And she actually recorded every single thing of how this organized criminal group operates in Moldova with money coming from Russia. But also our law enforcement is becoming more adept in dismantling these networks. But of course, it takes time through the justice system for these actors to be actually prosecuted.
Yeah. I mean, I know that you're saying, look, there was a big vote buying and disinformation campaign that you were up against. But nonetheless, victory has been by a wafer-thin majority, assuming this, you know, the figures hold up. But also in the accompanying vote on the presidency, the president whom you support, she got a lot less than was forecast. I mean, she now goes into a runoff with somebody who is seen as being perhaps closer to Moscow. It suggests that actually people in Moldova are withholding judgment.
In fact, the forecasts have been largely confirmed. President Sandu did incredibly well, considering the struggles that the country has gone through. And the fact that she has about 43% and the second place is about 26%, that's a very big disparity. And that is a vote of confidence for President Sandu and for our team.
I wonder if in moments of cool reflection, you and others will think, actually, maybe it was a bit of a mistake to bring this referendum, because you didn't need to. And it feels as if it's rather backfired. And what you've done is just show up how divided the country is.
Not really. We've shown that the country is united behind European integration. You know, the Republic of Moldova is in a very turbulent region, and we have many pro-Russian proxies in the political space in Moldova. But everybody will be bound by the will of the people to be part of the European family of nations.
That's Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister Mihai Popșoi talking to Tim Franks. So are his complaints sour grapes, or is there something in them? Paula Erizanu is a Moldovan journalist and writer based in the capital Chișinău. She gave me a pen portrait of her country.
Moldova has quite a complicated history. It's tiny. It's between Romania and Ukraine. And historically, it developed as part of the kind of medieval Romanian states alongside Wallachia and Transylvania. But it was occupied by the Russian Empire in 1812. And it then became part of Romania in the interwar period. And it was once again occupied by the Soviet Union after the Second World War. And then it got independence in 1991. And we're still fighting for our independence today, as you can see from the recent elections.
Yeah, and of course, you've got a part of the country, Transnistria, which is effectively separate or governed separately and looks very much towards Russia. On that question of, even if we accept the claims the government is making of Russian meddling, surely that can't in itself explain the apparently lukewarm level of support for the European Union in Moldova.
So the opinion polls have consistently shown between 55% and around 65% of support for the European Union, and that's excluding the diaspora, which is overwhelmingly pro-European.
Yeah, but the vote was barely 13,500 votes between the yes and the no. And given the scale of the vote, that's quite a small margin.
Yes, but at the same time, if we take these accusations of vote buying seriously, and if we take the 300,000 votes that Maya Sandu was talking about as being as having been bought or having been targeted to be bought by these Shores criminal network, basically, then we are talking about around 8 to 10% of the votes. So that would explain the kind of difference between opinion polls and the actual results. But of course, there are also kind of divisions within the country that have been shown in this.
Brief last thought, just a factual thing. Even if it goes ahead, how long would it be before Moldova would be a member of the EU?
So the government and EU officials have talked about 2030. As a possible date, but of course we'd have to see how the war in Ukraine goes and so and elections in America and so on.
Paula Erizanu, journalist in Chișinău, the capital of Moldova, speaking to NewsHour here on the BBC World Service. This is Sean Lay with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Now, a civil trial began Monday involving the world's largest mining company. BHP is facing charges over the collapse of a Brazilian dam 9 years ago. 19 people died after toxic mud and waste flooded the nearby area in November 2015. Hundreds more were left homeless. The dam was part of a mining joint venture between BHP and Vale, another mining firm. So many claim they've been affected that nearly 700,000 people are involved in court action against the companies in both London and the Netherlands. BHP and Vale deny liability. They say they've already funded nearly $8 billion worth of repairs and compensation. Our South America correspondent Annie Wells reports.
Mariana is a quaint historic town in the mountains of southeast Brazil. Its windy cobbled streets and soundtracks of birds and church bells make for a peaceful setting. But 9 years ago, it was making headlines, the scene of Brazil's worst environmental disaster.
19 people are still missing after the rupture of two...
One person has been confirmed dead, but at least a dozen are reported to be missing.
The last words I heard from him was he saying to me, "Mom, did you know that you are the best mom in the world?"
I'm at the house now of Giovanna Rodriguez. Her son, Thiago, was 7 years old when he was killed in the dam collapse.
When the disaster happened, he was in the next town, where he stayed with his grandmother so I could work. I heard the news, I ran there, and I saw everything destroyed. 7 days and seven nights passed before I heard that they had found the body.
I'm in Bento Rodriguez now, which is one of the towns that was completely destroyed by the disaster. It's now basically a ghost town. Most of the houses here are complete ruins. Some of them still have mud all the way up the walls.
Minha casa, igual falei com vocês, né? Aqui.
Marcos Muniz, known as Marquinhos, is one of the people who used to live in this town. His house was completely washed away in the disaster. You can now only just see the tip of it poking out of the brown water.
Cheguei em Bento.
I arrived here when I was 6 with my family. Then my dad bought the land where I built my house when I was older. I knew that here I would have the livestock, pigs and orange trees. Now, the house that I inherited from my father is inside the lake there. We were raised here.
Protests still take place regularly in Mariana. At this one, a group of people are gathering outside a court with banners, with megaphones, protesting against what happened. Vale and BHP have set up a foundation called the Renova Foundation, responsible for compensating people. They've given people the option of money or a new house in a new city that they've constructed. Hundreds have been built already. They're big, modern houses. But it is a different feel in this community to the old Bento Rodriguez. Fernanda Lavarello is the head of corporate affairs at BHP Brazil.
What happened in 2015 was a tragedy. Since then, BHP never abandoned the country, and BHP is here since the beginning, since the one doing everything you can to repair the environment and the life of those families.
Some people are very happy here with their new way of life, their new home. But for people like Marquinhos, he wants a house on his own rural land again, not one in a new modern city with a different way of life. For Giovanna, nothing can compensate for losing her son.
It's impossible, impossible, because nothing can bring a life back. There is no money in the world that can buy a life.
That report from Ione Wells. In Guatemala, a prominent investigative journalist has been released to house arrest after spending more than 800 days in detention. José Ruén Zamora, founder and publisher of the newspaper El Periódico, was jailed under the country's former president. He now awaits retrial on money laundering charges he calls politically motivated. José Carlos Zamora is his son, and when he came into the NewsHour studio, I asked how José Ruén is faring.
We managed to have a couple of lengthy telephone conversations, and it was great. He probably feels like he's in a spa back at home. So he's just relaxing and sleeping and taking it easy. He was arbitrarily detained for 813 days. He was by himself in solitary confinement.
The charges against him were dropped, or rather annulled, and put down for retrial, what, a year ago now, and that retrial still hasn't happened.
It hasn't happened, but it has been moved to September 23rd, 2025. So it's a year from now. So it's excessive and it's abusive. Probably by December or January, if he had been convicted, he would have already completed his sentence, which is amazing, right? Completing a sentence in pretrial detention for a crime he did not commit.
Crime he didn't commit. He was convicted of money laundering. What do you say to that charge? I know they were all annulled, but so were the not guilty verdicts as well. Everything is going to start again.
Yes, so he's innocent. This all started as a fabricated case by a general attorney's office that it's world-renowned for being anti-democratic and corrupt. She has been banned from 43 countries. She lost visas. Not only they fabricate the case, but throughout the process, they also violated all of his fundamental rights. They persecuted 10 of his lawyers. They also persecuted his main witness. So they really wanted to leave him defenseless.
All of this dates from his time as publisher of El Periódico. What was it he did, you believe, in that job that made him a target for these authorities?
His team at El Periódico and him, like, they have a very lengthy 30-year career in doing investigative journalism. But specifically in the previous administration, President Yamatei, El Periódico published 144 investigations into corruption in the government in the first 144 weeks of the administration.
One a week. Now, since your father was detained, there has been a significant political change in Guatemala, the election of a new president, a president who fought on an anti-corruption ticket. Were you pleased to see that change in power?
Definitely. It's a big advancement. I believe the new president is genuinely a decent man. He believes in freedom. He believes in democracy. He says the right things. Now I'm looking forward to seeing some action. I think one big change that it's important is that we just re-elected new courts. The process wasn't perfect, but we'll have to give them the benefit of the doubt. In terms of Arevalo, I think he is in a very difficult situation because...
This is the president.
The president, yeah. Because the previous administration co-opted the general attorney's office and a series of judges within the judiciary. And basically, they are a criminal cell within the judiciary and the general attorney's office. And they are the major threat and obstacle to regaining democracy.
That's José Carlos Zamora talking to NewsHour. Thanks for your company.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast, and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.